going to focus on the patient who has intracranial bleeds.
There was 100% an immediate reversal in the laboratory values that they were looking for. Do you give four-factor PCC or do you give FFP? The same company makes both dabigatran and the reversal agent. What a conflict of interest there is there. Be skeptical about this.
Welcome back to Critical Care Perspectives in Emergency Medicine. This is Mike Winters here from the University of Maryland School of Medicine in Baltimore, and I am so excited for this podcast. We are bringing back a CCPEM favorite, Brian Hayes, emergency medicine pharmacist extraordinaire, international superstar, any and everything related to EM education and pharmacy. Brian is simply continuing to make a name for himself across the world. Brian, thanks so much for joining us again here on the podcast.
Thanks, Mike. It's good to be back. And I will say I am very much looking forward to seeing you again in person at AAEM in April.
We are just a few short weeks away from heading west here to San Diego for AAEM, our resuscitation course there along with the main conference. What I wanted to get you on the podcast for is something that we actually worked on together for AAEM, the Clinical Practice Guidelines Committee. You and I had the opportunity to partner on a clinical guidance or position statement on reversing patients who have life-threatening bleeding secondary to dabigatran. But before we jump into our clinical topic, a lot has happened in your life, Brian. Can you bring the listeners a little bit up to date where you're at?
Sure. So back in the middle of 2016, we made the very difficult decision to leave the University of Maryland and move back home closer to our families in the Boston area. So I am working at Massachusetts General Hospital. And just this past year or two, I had the faculty appointment at the Harvard Medical School also went through. So I'm officially faculty now in emergency medicine department. So that is exciting. It took a little while to transition from one hospital to the next, but back into the swing of things now and starting to publish again and get some research done and doing a lot of teaching as well.
I love reading your stuff on academic life and emergency medicine, following your Twitter feed, and then all of the podcasts you're doing. So thanks for all the great work that you're doing.
Thanks. It's kind of overwhelming sometimes. I sometimes wonder how I found myself here, but it's been a great ride and I love to teach and it's just been a great opportunity.
Well, many of our patients don't know what goes on behind the scenes, but you clearly are affecting and improving care of many of our emergency medicine patients across the globe. Well, let's get into our clinical topic and we're going to focus on the patient who has intracranial bleeds. We see this day in, day out, regardless of the practice setting we are in, emergency departments, acute care settings, intensive care units. And often, many of these patients are, in fact, anticoagulated. I think many of us know what to do with the patient who has a warfarin-related intracranial hemorrhage, but there's not so much guidance regarding the newer oral anticoagulants. I guess you can't really call them new anymore. Brian, many have been out for many years. But nonetheless, the direct thrombin inhibitors and then the factor 10A inhibitors. And you recently gave an outstanding lecture at the end of December that I thought would be really, really great to start off here 2018 with in terms of reversal strategies for these specific medications. So take us through this. Let's get started and talk about what to do for reversing patients who have acute intracranial bleeding.
Awesome. Thanks, Mike. So this is obviously a huge topic. And it's funny, it's not really a topic I was always interested in per se. I do have a toxicology training background, but this was just kind of one of those things that seemed like the sexy topic that everyone was talking about. So usually I steer away from those and try and focus on things that deserve some more attention. Then you and I got together and we wrote that clinical practice statement on dabigatran reversal. And then I ended up writing another review article that just came out a couple months ago. And then I gave a talk. So it's kind of blown up into this thing that I didn't really anticipate, but it's a very large topic. What we're not going to talk about today is the laboratory values that go along with it. What I want to focus on in the next 20 minutes or so is really just what to do when they come in terms of treatment. Our jobs are very challenging, but I like to try to keep things simple. And so for each of the drugs that we're going to talk about, I want us to think about it in terms of a four-step process. And some of these are really obvious, like step one is DC the drug. So if they are on dabigatran, don't give them more. I think that's pretty obvious, but it's a good first step. And then step two is an antidote. So if there is an antidote available, then that would be your next line of therapy. So the first one we're going to talk about here is itaracizumab. The brand name is Praxbind, and that is for dabigatran reversal. So if you have a direct thrombin inhibitor overdose or a bleed with dabigatran, this would be a drug that you probably stock in your hospital and you would reach for. There was a bunch of preclinical studies, I shouldn't say non-human studies. They were human studies, but they were in healthy volunteers, really just to try and figure out how the drug worked, how long it lasted, what its effects were on labs. And what they found is that it has a half-life of about 45 minutes, which isn't necessarily too important for us in the ED. But when they gave healthy volunteers who had been getting doses of dabigatran, they gave them this itaracizumab, there was 100% an immediate reversal in the laboratory values that they were looking for. And they looked at eCarin clotting time, the APTT, and then the thrombin time. And what they found too is that in these healthy volunteers anyway, there were relatively few adverse events. I had a case back at Maryland, ended up reporting, where the patient came in with a GI bleed on dabigatran that got started recently for atrial fibrillation. And we gave this drug because he was quite sick. And we sent the thrombin time prior, really more of just as a test to see how our hospital handled it and what the turnaround time was. And at least at Maryland, the turnaround time was about an hour. So we were pretty impressed with that, and it really helped guide our therapy. But the labs do get reversed relatively quickly with this itaracizumab after you give it. The one study I actually want to focus on is the big one, and this is the one that everyone should know about. It actually got published in two parts. Both of them were in the New England Journal of Medicine. And it was itaracizumab for dabigatran reversal by Pollock and colleagues. The first one was in 2015, and then the final cohort was in 2017. And basically what they did is they just took all comers who were on dabigatran and needed reversal. They separated them out into a group A, which was uncontrolled bleeding, and then they separated the other group was group B, and those were patients that needed reversal for urgent or emergent surgery. It's kind of interesting. They looked at lab parameters for the reversal effect rather than clinical outcomes as their primary endpoint. But that was the easiest thing to do, I guess, because it's not always easy to know when patients have stopped bleeding. So they looked for maximum percent reversal within the first 4 hours, and they were looking at mostly the thrombin time or the eCarin clotting time. And I want to point out a couple things on this. And there's been a couple of blogs recently that have highlighted some of the points that I've been making all along. And I realize that we need to be skeptical in everything and all the data that comes out. But in my opinion, this is the type of study that we need to be even more skeptical about for a couple of reasons. One is that the same company makes both dabigatran and the reversal agent. And I realize that, okay, that's one thing, but what a conflict of interest there is there. I mean, you're making basically the poison and the antidote. And, you know, you kind of worry they had their hand in both of the studies for both of those drugs. And it's just something that kind of strikes me as a little bit concerning.
Completely agree with that, yeah.
Yeah. So both were funded basically by the company, both the interim analysis and the full analysis in this itaracizumab trial. One thing to note too is there was no control group. So they took all comers, but they weren't comparing it to placebo or anything else. This is probably the biggest point for me, and that in the interim analysis, there was less than 100 patients, but they found that when they tried to look for bleeding cessation, not by labs, but by actual visualization or whatever other means, they found it was about 11.4 hours. And quite honestly, that's what you and I saw in the patient that we had. But in the full analysis, they reported 2.5 hours. And that's quite a disparity between bleeding cessation. And in the ED or a critical care unit, wherever, that's a huge difference. And it could be a life-saving difference for patients. And if you look into the details of the study even further, you find that in the full analysis, most of group A, which was the uncontrolled bleeding patients, were excluded from that assessment. And the reasons that they said were that there was no cessation of bleeding within 24 hours or the bleeding location could not be identified. Now, I get that. I realize that it's very challenging to confirm bleeding cessation, but this change in the way that they reported it clearly favors itaracizumab in the full analysis. Another thing that was important is that in the interim analysis and the full analysis, anywhere between 10 and 25% of patients had normal thrombin times prior to receiving the antidote. So that means that they were not actually anticoagulated. So that clearly favors the drug too, because we don't have a control group. So if they were normal to begin with, they're going to be normal afterwards. That's just something to note as well. Both studies reported about a 5% thrombotic event rate after the drug too, which is not surprising. If someone's being anticoagulated and you reverse them, then there is a chance they will have clotting. So I don't think that's surprising, but just be skeptical about this. I do not think that this trial, although it is the major trial for this drug right now. I don't think that it meets the standard criteria for randomized controlled trials that have placebo groups or control groups. And now this is going to become the standard of care, if not already in a lot of places, which leads me to my next point. I think there's legal implications here. So you have an antidote for a drug, and let's say you decide that for whatever reason, your patient should not get this antidote. Are you going to be held liable for not giving the patient the antidote for the drug and going a different direction? I don't know the answer to that, but it's just something to think about.
I think you've brought up some incredibly important points about both of these trials and probably some information that many of our listeners, while they may be familiar with the medication and may be familiar that there are recent publications, may not have had the opportunity to delve that deep into the study. So great, great pearls, Brian.
Thank you. I won't go into any of the other studies in that amount of detail, mostly because there aren't any that were that sort of prominent of studies. But I thought it was important to highlight that just because I agree. I think we have a drug, we have an indication for it, and we go for it. But the data is not that great for giving it. There's also cases of sustained bleeding, such as the case that we had. So just because it fixes the lab values does not necessarily mean it fixes the actual injured vessel. And so you still may need repeat antidote dosing or factor replacement in addition. So just realize it's not necessarily a silver bullet.
All right. What else can be given then? We are familiar with idarucizumab. What about factor replacement for these patients?
It's a great question. And so remember, step one, DC the drug. Step two would be an antidote if it's available. Step three for me is factor replacement. And when you and I looked at the data for this for our AAEM clinical practice statement, what we found is that there's really not a lot. I thought there would be more. There was a grand total of about 40 patients that had been given factors, and most of them were healthy volunteers, and they were simply looking at laboratory reversal. What I can say and what you and I concluded from that, and I think is important, is that the options available to us depend on your hospital. So the second factors that you might have would be APCC or activated PCC, and that is the brand name FIBA, factor 8 inhibitor bypassing activity. If you look at all the data for dabigatran reversal, you'll find that the data supports APCC over four-factor PCC. So if you have APCC available, that should be your primary factor replacement option for dabigatran, keeping in mind that there's very little data for both of these. The one interesting thing is that there was a small case series of patients who actually needed reversal, and 14 of them got APCC. And this was prior to the antidote being available. And so basically we're recruiting all these patients for this big case series. But then once the antidote became available, they stopped because no one else was using APCC as much anymore. But they found that out of those 14 cases, 9 of them had a good outcome and 5 had moderate. So there was at least some benefit with APCC in patients that actually needed it. So I thought that was helpful.
All right. So we've done the antidote. We've done factor replacement. Any other therapies we should consider in this particular patient on this medicine?
There's just two, and this is step 4 of my algorithm, and that is the adjunctive therapy. One would be activated charcoal, and I realize that in some respects, activated charcoal has fallen out of favor. In some circles, I think as a toxicologist, we still think of this as a good primary decontamination method. So if you have someone that comes in after an overdose, I think it's totally worth giving them a dose of activated charcoal. If they're already bleeding, whether GI, don't give them charcoal if they're GI bleeding. The other one is renal replacement therapy. So whether that be hemodialysis or CVVH, this drug is eliminated by the kidneys. And so that can help get rid of the drug. And if it's indicated for your patient, then that's totally one that you could use as well.
Outstanding pearls on dabigatran-associated life-threatening hemorrhage, i.e. the patient with intracerebral hemorrhage. Do you want to shift now to, rather than the direct thrombin inhibitors, the other class of medications that many of our folks come in on, and that's the factor 10A inhibitors?
Yes, definitely. And then we'll just briefly touch on warfarin at the end for a couple of teaching points. So again, same process. Step one, DC the drug. Very easy. Step two, antidote. Now, this is a tricky one because the antidote for this drug, Indexina alpha, is not actually available right now in the U.S. It's a study drug. So there's many hospitals, including my own at Mass General, that are one of the study sites for this. So we don't have that available at this time. So I just want to very briefly go through this because if we don't have it available, it's not necessarily worth talking about quite yet. Just know that they are looking at it in both apixaban and rivaroxaban bleeding cases.
Indexinet alpha is a little bit more challenging to give than idarucizumab because it's not only a bolus, but it is followed by an infusion. The dosing's not very important to get into right now, as we'll wait to see what the final dosing is when it's FDA approved, but just know that it's going to be a bolus and an infusion.
Right now, the only data that's out there is a 2016 New England Journal of Medicine article from Conley and colleagues with 67 patients. It's very similar to the idarucizumab stuff. So this is the interim analysis. They're planning on reporting the full analysis later. And their endpoint, again, was not clinical outcomes, but anti-factor 10A activity, so a lab value. And very similar to what they found with idarucizumab for dabigatran, they found that patients' lab values corrected very quickly. And in the cases where they looked at it, that there seemed to be good hemostasis. There was a 20% thrombotic event rate so far, so that's higher than what was in the idarucizumab trial. So we'll have to see how that gets reported in the end. And again, there was no control group, and it is not approved by the FDA quite yet. I think it's important to talk about up-and-coming antidote. It's only in very early studies right now, but it's called seropentag. And the reason I'm excited about it is because it's not specific for one type of anticoagulant. It looks like it should be effective for factor 10A inhibitors, low molecular weight heparin, regular heparin, dabigatran, and maybe even others. So look for this in the next couple of years to maybe hit the market as another option as an antidote for these anticoagulants.
Outstanding.
All right, step three, factors. Again, very little data, mostly in just healthy patients. But the takeaway from this is that for dabigatran, it was APCC as your primary agent, but for factor 10A inhibitors, it should be four-factor PCC. That's where the data seems to point. Now, if you don't have that, APCC is an acceptable alternative, but if you have the four-factor PCC, that should be your go-to for reversing.
Anything else? Well,
yep, just one last thing. And this one is a little bit more important, I think. As an adjunctive therapy, you can't use dialysis for these drugs, but you can use charcoal. And the reason I wanted to make this an extra point here is that there was a recent study in 2017 that actually found that even up to 8 hours after a dose of one of these agents, that you still have up to a 30 or 40% reduction in the absorption. So what I'm saying here is that normally we think of charcoal in like the 1 to 2 hours after a dose kind of thing, but there's data now to say that even up to 8 hours after a dose, you can reduce absorption significantly for these factor 10A inhibitors. So don't be afraid to give it, even if they present to you after an overdose several hours later.
Very, very helpful, Brian. Well, should we wrap up with a few teaching pearls on warfarin?
Yes, we should. I think so. I know this is the drug that's been around the longest and we feel like we know it, but now with four-factor PCC available, I think it changes the game a little bit, especially in terms of intracranial hemorrhage. So again, DC drug, step one. Step two is antidote. Now, don't forget about vitamin K. This is an antidote for warfarin. It needs to be IV in these cases. The general dose that most people give and is pretty consistent with the guidelines is 10 milligrams. In order to reduce the risk of any anaphylactoid reactions, we usually dilute it in 50 or 100 mLs of fluid and give it over 30 minutes. Now, I realize right now we were dealing with a very serious fluid shortage, but this is a drug that still needs to be diluted before giving it. It should not be given IV push. But the vitamin K needs a partner. It doesn't work right away. Even the IV onset is about 6 to 8 hours before you start to get an effect. So you need something that can start acting much more quickly than that. And so the question is, do you give four-factor PCC or do you give FFP? Those are kind of your two options. Now, there are some risks with FFP. There's some transfusion-related lung injury or reactions, hypocalcemia, a couple of other risks with FFP. The INR of FFP is somewhere around 1.5, 1.6. So if you really need to get the patient completely reversed, FFP is not going to actually do that for you. And then time, depending on how long it takes you to get an urgent dose of FFP, to get it thawed, to get it cross-matched if you need to, there can be some time associated with getting that into the patient and getting reversal. Four-factor PCC, specifically in intracranial hemorrhage patients, has been studied, and it's faster at reversing the laboratory values. So I feel like if you have four-factor PCC available, then that is your way to go. Particularly the INCH trial looked at this, and they found that the INR less than 1.2 was their endpoint, and four-factor PCC got there 67% of the time, and FFP only 9% of the time. So there's actually some data for INR. And if you want a little bit more of a clinical outcome, the hematoma expansion was significantly less with four-factor PCC. It was 10 mLs versus 24 mLs with FFP. So we do have some actual data to say that FFP is probably better if you have that available to you. And the very last point I want to make about four-factor PCC is that there is the FDA-approved dosing, which is based on the patient's weight in the INR. But several hospitals have now published data on a fixed dose PCC. And at my hospital right now, we're at the very final stages of approving a fixed dose PCC policy as well. And so instead of waiting for the INR to come back and figure out the patient's weight and calculating a dose, if you just give a fixed dose, and it seems to be 1,500 units, which is the fixed dose that most hospitals have used, that is effective.
With fixed dose Kcentra, you can save money and you can save time because you don't have to wait for the INR to come back. And so this would be a quicker way to get the drug into the patient and hopefully start that reversal almost immediately.
So I think that that's something important. And I guess my concluding point would be that it was funny. I was giving a talk on this in December, and the day of my talk, I got an email that the American Heart Association had come out with a new sort of expert consensus recommendations on reversing anticoagulants. So I had to look through very quickly to see if I needed to update anything in my talk. And they are actually now recommending fixed dose PCC in some warfarin cases. So take a look at those guidelines to see if that applies to your patients. But just know that this fixed dose is becoming a thing with data behind it and even expert consensus recommendations. So could be the wave of the future for a lot of places.
Outstanding. Now, just really quick, going back to something that you had said, I think that you meant to say four-factor PCCs over FFP. In one of those statements, I think you said FFP, but I think I got from what you were saying all over, just to confirm, four-factor PCC better than FFP for warfarin.
Yes, if I misspoke, yeah, I apologize. Thanks for pointing that out. So yes, in most cases, and the data actually supports this, is that four-factor PCC should be your primary option over FFP.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, Brian, this has been enormously helpful. You've really brought us up to date where we stand in January of 2018. We are going to link to your handout, post this with the podcast. It is truly a great, great resource, probably something that you'll want to print out. Brian has gone through really an extensive amount of literature. He has all the literature references in his handout and really goes through a nice systematic way with step 1, 2, 3, and 4 for each of these medications. So we'll link to that with this particular podcast. Brian, this has been enormously helpful. It's been so great to get you back on the podcast and so great to start 2018 out with Brian Hayes back on CCPEM.
Thanks, Mike. I appreciate it, and I'll see you real soon.
Well, my thanks again to Brian Hayes for some outstanding pearls on reversing some of our more common anticoagulant medications for those patients presenting with acute life-threatening hemorrhage. If you have any questions whatsoever for Brian or myself regarding this podcast, please shoot us an email. We'll get you an answer to that. But notwithstanding, he's Brian Hayes. I'm Mike Winters from the University of Maryland in Baltimore. We look forward to talking with you on our next podcast.